Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. I thank you so much for joining me again this week. Before we take a walk into the briefing room where I'm going to give you my view from the blue, I just want you to stick around, make sure that you want to listen to my guest this week. Because if you want to know what really happened in Ferguson, Missouri, when the Michael Brown shooting happened, you're going to want to hear my guest, Tom Jackson, the former chief. But for the moment, let's take a walk into the briefing room where I'm going to give you my view from the blue.
The briefing room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
One of the people that I have absolutely no respect for is the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel. He has been so entirely ineffective in combating the violent crime rate in Chicago because of his liberal mentality and failure to lead the people in the proper direction. And he's been completely ineffective. And as a result, what do you see? You see, you know, the violent crime rate in Chicago just through the roof, astronomical. The city of Chicago Police Department really is in need of the city's leadership, and they're not getting it. And what all they're getting is more liberal nonsense and more constraints put on them because of political correctness. And without the proper guidance and without the proper leadership, the problem is going to continue. So how does Rahm Emanuel this week, what does he do to help his people out? Well, instead of really worrying about the violent crime rate, he decides that he's going to sue the federal government because he wants all the millions of dollars for anti-crime funds, but he doesn't want to have to follow the rules and regulations that go along with the money. You know, those little rules and regulations like, hey, you have to tell Immigration Service when you're going to release offenders from jail a minimum of 48 hours. That's all that has to be done here. Now, why is that such a difficult concept? There are so many offenders that commit crime after crime after crime. Every law enforcement officer knows this, that roughly 80% of the crime is committed by about 20% of the people. So when you find a guy that has committed a robbery, the chances are he's been committing more than that single robbery. Same thing with car thefts and burglaries and et cetera, et cetera. So Chicago arrests an illegal immigrant, illegal alien. And the Trump administration is doing their very best to get rid of criminal aliens. And the way that they do that is through following the law. That's all. If you're in this country illegally, you have committed another crime, and now you're in jail. It's up to the city or the county, depending on where the person is incarcerated, to notify ICE that you're going to release him. And if they deem that individual to be a criminal alien and subject to deportation, then they come get him. This isn't rocket science. And we're talking about millions of dollars tied to this in grants. Grants granted to cities that seem to wave the banner of sanctuary city like it's something that they should be proud of. Now, I am a great believer in the fact that immigrants have built this country. But the majority that have made the contributions are people who came to this country legally. Now, I know that this system that we have in place in this country is broken. There's no doubt about it. And this government, stretching back through generations, have failed to reform the immigration rules and regulations and And it's a travesty. It should be done. But there is something in place, and that is the law of the land. And it is incumbent upon people to follow the law. Now, here is Rahm Emanuel, the ineffective leader of Chicago. And instead of helping rid his city of people that prey on others, he decides he wants to protect them. But he still wants the money, the millions of dollars that go along with these federal grants. He still wants that. Well, you can't have your cake and eat it too, Mr. Mayor. So now he's going to waste hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money. And we know how screwed up the city of Chicago is financially and the state of Illinois is because of politics and because of political pandering and corruption and greed, all at the political level. And now they're going to spend more of the taxpayers' money because they don't want to enforce the simple laws that are on the books. You know, there are tons of federal agencies. There's the FEC, there's just, you know, a ton of alphabets out there, right? And they don't have any problem following those federal regulations. So why is this one so much more difficult? It is the law. That's it in a nutshell. So now this is going to continue. And another, because of the politics involved in these sanctuary cities, they're not the only ones. As a matter of fact, the city of Denver, which is another bastion of liberalism, has now created laws, city ordinances, that forbid the police department from notifying ICE. So what's going to happen? You got a guy that commits a robbery, and he gets released without notifying ICE. Well, we could get rid of these guys, send them back to whichever country they came from. But no, let's keep them in the community. Let's create laws that protect them. It's mind-numbing to hear this. You know, I've worked in the Hispanic community for years and years and years, and they are a very vulnerable group of folks, because especially when you're talking about the undocumented people that are in these communities are preyed upon more by the criminal element within the same community. And why is that? Because they know that they are so vulnerable and they are less likely to contact the police. So it is imperative, and it's a very difficult thing to do, for law enforcement officers on the municipal level, city and county police officers, to create relationships within these communities that they serve. And they do that very, very well. But at the same time, the balance has to be made where law enforcement officers are not ICE agents, right? They don't actively enforce immigration laws. And that's the way it should be. But when you get into where the people are already incarcerated, and the law is that ICE has a right to know who's going to be released within 48 hours. That is not asking a whole lot. And for people like Rahm Emanuel and this moronic mayor in Denver, who's this isn't the first time I've talked about him either. He's another sweetheart. What they're doing is a disservice to their communities. They're making it a more dangerous place to be. And the fact of the matter is that it is the communities that they supposedly serve that are going to be the victims of this criminal element. So that's part of my view from the blue. If you have security needs, that is, if your company needs security, we all need security, right? But if your company needs security or your business, the person you want to talk to is Doug Carter of JSD Protective Services. That's jsdprotectiveservices.com. Go check out their website. Now, I'm really impressed with their operation. I've met their folks, I've met Doug, and his commitment to the top training for the these security officers is pretty impressive. These men and women that work for him are consummate security professionals, and they've got armed security. They do pretty much everything in the realm of security, which includes bodyguarding, private investigation, and they're all over the United States. So check them out, JSD Protective Services. Tell them Randy sent you. Another thing that I want to bring up today, Colin Kaepernick. I'm so tired of hearing about this moron. We all know who Colin Kaepernick is. He's I don't even know what team he plays for. I forgot. It means so little to me. But he's the one that decided that he didn't like his country enough to stand for the national anthem. And so he took a knee in his protest of the police, because the police, of course, are you know, to blame for everything in the world. And the fans have reacted to that. The fans have decided, well, they don't like Colin Kaepernick. And I don't blame him, because all he is another snowflake, another self-entitled multimillionaire sports figure who, instead of standing up for the country that has given him the opportunities that he has decided that he is going to rebel against that country and against everything that it stands for. So he made the conscious effort, and he made a great political grandstanding portrayal of his intentions. And he's been hailed as a hero by certain people in the left that have taken up his cause. Well, you know, it all comes down to economics sometimes, right? Colin Kaepernick, I guess I think he's a quarterback or something. And he hasn't been signed by anybody else. So he's out of the contract and nobody's signing him. Gee, I wonder why, Colin or whatever the hell your name is. Why would a team want to sign you if A, you're just not that good to begin with, and B, all you do is bring negative attention onto your team? Why would they want you? So nobody does. Nobody's signing them. But, and that's the way that economics works. And, you know, he's now become somewhat of a pariah. Well, that's apparently sticking in the craw of a bunch of activists, including Spike Lee. There's another sweetheart. So now there are protests of the NFL. Protests in support of Kaepernick, and claiming that now there is some conspiracy against him based on race that is keeping him from being signed. So it's, once again, it's not his fault. It's not his fault for making the decisions that he made and now facing the ramifications of those decisions. No. It's not his fault. It's all the team's fault. It's everybody in the NFL's fault for not wanting to sign this moron. And now there's going to be protests. And Spike Lee, let me read what he tweeted out here. Tweeted with a picture of Kaepernick on his knee. I did not organize and set up this protest. However, I still support my brother and his stance on the injustices in the USA. That's right. So once again, we have the liberal left, instead of taking credit for their own decisions and taking responsibilities, now they're going to blame it on everybody else except for them. And Spike Lee, of course, has had an anti-law enforcement stance for a long, long time. And we're seeing more of the same. So that's another thing I wanted to bring up. But we're not done yet, because I have a few more minutes. You know, one of the things that we have seen around the country is the attacks on law enforcement officers. Right now, this year, we are about 75 law enforcement officers who have been killed in the line of duty. And the manner of death including accidents are one thing, but the assaults on law enforcement officers are totally another. To show you how any interaction a police officer can have can turn deadly in just a moment, I want to tell you about something that happened in Joplin, Missouri just yesterday. Police stopped a pickup truck for a crack taillight or a taillight out, something very minor equipment violation. But even these terribly minor infractions can lead to a life and death situation. That's exactly what happened with these officers. They walked up on the truck, and the driver threw a bomb at them. Yeah, you heard me right. He tossed a bomb at them, and thank God it exploded far enough away that it didn't injure the officers. The suspects then fled. The officers were in pursuit, and they threw another bomb at them. The officers backed off, and the suspects crashed their pickup truck and eventually were apprehended. This type of attack shows you how deadly that these every interaction can have the possibility of being a fatal interaction. So when law enforcement makes approaches and they do so very cautiously, that sometimes gives the impression of being paranoid. Well, it's not paranoia. It's called preparation, because every single encounter, a police officer has to be able to go into warrior mentality mode, where they have to go from being that polite officer friendly to protecting their own life and even taking the life of the individual who is posing the threat. So this is one of the things that the American public sometimes doesn't understand, and they get a feeling that the officers are overreacting. I wish that were the case, that these officers are overreacting. But the reality is that they have to be so on guard at every single moment of the day, and that can take a very great toll on an officer's emotional and mental health. So that, my friends, is my view from the blue for today. If you have security needs, that is, if your company needs security, we all need security, right? But if your company needs security, or your business, the person you want to talk to is Doug Carter of JSD Protective Services. That's jsdprotectiveservices.com. Go check out their website. Now, I'm really impressed with their operation. I've met their folks. I've met Doug, and his commitment to the top training for these security officers is pretty impressive. These men and women that work for him are consummate security professionals, and they've got armed security. They do pretty much everything in the realm of security, which includes bodyguarding, private investigation, and they're all over the United States. So check them out, JSD Protective Services. Tell them Randy sent you. Before we take a walk into the interview room, one thing I wanted to let you know is that I recently had the honor of being a keynote speaker down in Texas. And I got to tell you that one of the things that I really enjoy is getting to meet personally with the people that listen to this radio program. So if you would like to talk to me about addressing your group, whether it is a law enforcement or a civic group or even a volunteer group, let me know. Contact me at randysutton@americaoutloud.com. Thanks. Now let's take a walk into the interview room.
We are one of the fastest growing podcast and talk radio networks in the world. You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. It's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. We stand proudly with the men and women who serve in our armed forces and our law enforcement heroes. Thank you for being part of our family. And we'll see you back at AmericaOutloud.com. Well, looking good and feeling good are not exactly the same thing. It's just like a car. It may look good from the outside, but what's the inside look like? More importantly than that, what's the inside of your cells look like? That's a question you need to ask yourself. Well, when I started taking Healthy Cell just a few months ago, it has changed my program. I mean, it's boosted my energy. I sleep better, sharper focus. I feel healthier, and hopefully we'll all live longer with improved cells. Well, 90-plus nutrients infused into every cell of your body. Well, this is an exclusive offer for Friends of America Out Loud. You can try it today free. When I say free, I mean free. It's our Healthy Cell Pro 7-Day Sample. Free shipping, no risk, no obligation, no credit card required. So this is a complimentary gift from America Out Loud. You can go to healthycell.com/outloudsample or just go to americaoutloud.com and click the large banner ad, and our complimentary gift will be on its way to your home.
With me today in the interview room at Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is a very special guest. He's been on the show before, but we've got some really exciting stuff going on. His name is Tom Jackson. He is the former police chief with Ferguson. He spent 31 years as a police officer in St. Louis County, and then 5 years as the chief at Ferguson, and of course was the chief at the time of the infamous Michael Brown shooting. And he has now come out with a brand new book, and it is kicking some butt. It's Policing Ferguson, Policing America, What Really Happened. Welcome, Tom. Thanks for being on Blue Lives Radio.
Good to talk to you again, Randy.
It's really exciting, man. So you just came out with this new book. Tell the listeners about the book itself.
Well, the book is really it's kind of the true story of Ferguson. You know what you saw on TV, but you know what I'm trying to say is what really happened. You know, I'll talk about, first of all, the horrors that the police officers went through on a daily basis for months. There was just violent anarchists and all kinds of vulgar people spewing vitriolic hatred and death threats at them all day and all night, you know, blocking the streets, keeping people from getting their homes. And, you know, the officers were just under this tremendous strain and pressure the whole time. And then, you know, once it got dark, the rocks had started flying, the bottles and the bricks and the urine. And then as it got later, the shots had started ringing out. And it was almost a nightly event for months. And, you know, what, of course, the press put out there was police suppressing peaceful protesters, you know, objecting to a young black man murdered in cold blood, you know, in broad daylight. So that's just, you know, that's one of the aspects. And I also talk about things such as optics, you know, and that's where people look at the way things look as opposed to the way things are, you know, and they use those things to talk about, you know, the press would talk about the militarized police as opposed to police officers in protective gear trying to keep the peace and keep order. And the book talks about the media and the social media, especially that took a lie, the hands up don't shoot lie, and turned it into a national disgrace and a story that didn't exist about racism and police oppression. And then I talk about the cowardly politicians that buried their heads and threw law enforcement under the bus.
Let's talk about that.
It's a feel good story.
A feel good story. Well, you know, let's talk about the political aspect of this, because I think that this was a watershed moment in law enforcement. Think that literally what happened in Ferguson changed policing forever, and much of that was because of the politics of it, and it came all the way from the White House.
It absolutely did. You know, the president comes out and he says, you know, something nice about, you know, you know, waiting to see what happened or something like that. And then he describes what happened, you know, police brutality and, you know, we've got to put an end to the police brutality and the killing of, you know, young black men and things like that. So he put a spin, a negative spin against law enforcement on it right away. And then, of course, his attorney general, who, you know, in my opinion, was just anti-police all the way, just ran with it. He just picked up that ball and ran with it.
I think that I've never seen a Department of Justice so weaponized against law enforcement than under his administration. And you bore the brunt of it without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, no question. He yields that pattern and practice investigation like a sword. And he's, you know, not just against us, but I mean, it was the most oppressive against us. Because you look at it, and is it just a coincidence that the same day he was forced to exonerate Darren Wilson, who was defending his own life, that same day he also decided that, the Ferguson Police Department was the most oppressive department in the history of the world.
Jesus.
And, I mean, that report was just rushed through so fast. They talked to, you know, they were out interviewing anarchists and people who were rioting the streets. What do you think about the Ferguson Police Department? You know, those kind of things. And that's what the report is largely based on, is just anecdotes, you know, anonymous anecdotes and mischaracterizations of events that actually did occur. You know, they take an event that was, properly done and then turn it into a terrible thing, you know, a brutality case.
I can't imagine the frustration that you must have undergone while you were in that position and being kind of powerless because of all the forces basically marshaled against you. And these are the forces that were supposed to be on your side.
Yeah, that was the worst part of it. They just they turned their backs on law enforcement right away. You know, some of them were speaking out openly and vocally against law enforcement, and then others were just hiding, you know, not saying anything, but not supporting the cops at all. So, we were kind of stunned by that, by how quickly we were all by ourselves trying to protect our city from the thousands of anarchists and you know, all those violent people that came in from all over the country.
When it comes down to, I mean, let's talk about Darren Wilson for a moment. You know, when I think of the victims of in law enforcement, he's the biggest victim of the whole thing. I mean, there's a guy that did nothing but his job, who had to save his own life, who did so responsibly, who did so within the confines of the law and his training. And he is still being victimized today.
He absolutely is. You know, his name is still associated with "Hands Up, Don't Shoot" and the conspiracy of law enforcement against unarmed black men to just gun them down in cold blood. You know, Darren. This guy hacked Darren, and you know, tried to disarm him and kill him, and proved that he could overpower Darren, and then and then tried to attack him again. And Darren was protecting his life. And his life was in danger because he was a police officer. That's why he was attacked. And yet, you put his name out there in the mainstream, and, he's the cause of it all. It's his fault.
It's really truly one of the greatest injustices in modern history, and it was perpetuated by a media that seemed hell-bent on an anti-law enforcement crusade.
Yeah, well, they started out with that bent. You know, a big portion of them started out just already anti-law enforcement and wanting to believe that the hands up, don't shoot scenario. And, of course, the streamers and the social media people are not bound by any rules of ethics at all. Not that any of them, apply them.
Did you say ethics and in the same connotation as the media?
Yeah, but it was a mistake. So anyway, you know, this event fed right into their right into their narrative of what law enforcement was, you know, because now they had a terrible, brutal slaying, and so they could just, you know, roll with that and use that in their narrative. And plus, if they kept fanning the flames, then, you know, they had an easy job. You know, all they had to do is show up in Ferguson, find some mutt walking around on the street with a sign, you know, Black Lives Matter or something, and interview him. You know, what have the police done to you? and you know, that was their working day.
Yeah, right. But, you know, when it comes down to the mayhem that was going on in your city, I mean, the victims were the honest business people that simply were trying to make a living, and basically law enforcement was handcuffed by the politicians, not allowed to even enforce the laws.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the Justice Department was there, and others, you know, who were telling us that, you know, they were going to come down even harder on us if we did this. We couldn't. These people would be marching around in our streets and our neighborhoods at 11 o'clock at night banging on drums and blowing horns. And if we'd go out there and arrest them the next day, you know, the newspaper would be Ferguson police arrest peaceful protesters. And then, of course, we'd have the Justice Department in our offices saying you can't arrest people for, you know, expressing their First Amendment rights, you know, and without any regard whatsoever for the rights of the people that actually lived in Ferguson who weren't, you know, raised in hell.
Was the Department of Justice, I mean, were they actually marching around your office and spouting off their quote recommendations, unquote, and orders?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they were there, you know, in some form or another every day. And, you know, they'd give me certified letters or whatever, you know, as some sort of point of law or recommendation or telling us that, you know, for example, our officers were getting called out by name because they were wearing name tags and being individually threatened, you know, I'm going to kill you, Officer Miller, I'm going to kill your family. And then they'd look, of course, on social media and find them. So, you know, we during the riots, we would have them not wear name tags. And of course, I got a letter from the Justice Department saying that was unconstitutional or illegal or something.
Are you kidding me?
No.
They got that far down in the weeds that they forced you to have your men identify themselves during a riot?
Yes. Yes, they did. And, you know, you're hand-strung when the United States government is there telling you, you know, this is what you have to do. You know, you can only fight them so much, and they've got all the guns, you know. And they're already let us know that they're doing this pattern and practice investigation, and, you know, so you better do this, or, you know, or we're going to get you. And, of course, it didn't matter. They got us for stuff we didn't do.
Yeah, right. That was a done deal. They couldn't get Darren Wilson as much as they seriously tried to. So they did the next best thing and laid all the blame on you and your department.
Well, sure. We talked to you know, people within the FBI and within the DOJ who told us that Eric Holder was angry that he couldn't get Darren Wilson, and that's why he wanted to really hammer us with this pattern and practice investigation.
You know, that's a good question. Let's explore that a little bit. The working agents, you know, the people from the FBI and the guys that are really out there doing the job, were they treating you okay, or were they being condescending and really negative towards you?
No, not at all. The FBI in St. Louis works very closely with law enforcement. And of course, I ran the drug task force. I retired as a captain from St. Louis County and ran the drug task force there for 12 years. So my interaction with the FBI personally was extensive. And, you know, so we have a good, you know, it may be different in other parts of the country, but we have an outstanding working relationship with the FBI. And these guys here, you know, they're just consummate professionals. You know, they were under pressure, I can tell you that, by the Civil Rights Division, by Eric Holder and so forth, to come up with something against Darren Wilson. But fortunately, these guys are professionals. They're uncorruptible, in my view, these guys we have here. And they just did their job. You know, and I have no doubt that had this been what they said it was, that these guys would have found that way and, you know, would have made that recommendation. But it simply wasn't. This was a justifiable shooting.
Oh, clearly this was a justifiable shooting. But it's good to know that the agents that actually conducted the investigation did so out of professionalism. But they did give you the word, on the side, that, hey, this they're trying to put the fix in.
Yeah, after the fact, you know, we got we got that word. We knew it anyway, you know, just because of the scuttlebutt, we knew what was going on. But at the same time, the DOJ would be telling us, no, you guys are doing all right. You know, we don't think we're going to have anything, you know, too bad here. You know, they were just playing us.
Yeah. Well, you know, how do you feel personally? I mean, you know, I was following, of course, the lawsuit that the Brown family, the settlement that they actually wound up getting, like, I think $1.5 million or something along that. That was settled. You know, how do you feel about the fact that they settled that case and didn't fight it all the way?
Well, there's, you know, obviously I can't talk about the intimacy of the talks and all that, but the thing is that the trial wasn't even set for until February of next year, so this thing would still be hanging over Darren's head and my head and the city's head, you know, till February, and then for a long trial that would have just been, you know, them pulling out this DOJ report and saying, you know, racism and oppression and brutality and on and on and on. One, but it would have been a media circus. And then following that, there would have been appeals and, you know, two or three more years of this nonsense at you know, huge expense. And so as far as Darren's concerned, though, his attitude was, look, I've been exonerated twice. You know, both on the state level and on the federal level. And he, you know, he wanted it over. And the reality of it is, you know, it's not like the Brown family got a big settlement. You know, the lawyers get a big chunk of it. And then,
right,
you know, there's her separately and him separately. So, you know, it's not like the family got a big chunk because they, you know, they are not together in any way.
Yeah, I know. It's just there's something that the injustice of them, you know, enriching themselves based on the criminality of their son. It's just something that it just sticks in my craw.
It leaves a bad taste in your mouth. I know that, and you know, lots of people have, you know, come up to me saying, "What the hell?" But you know, reality kind of jumps in these things, and
sure. Well, I read just yesterday, I wrote about it on my blog, I was shocked to see that punk that was with Brown, was it Dante something or other?
Dorian Johnson.
Dorian Johnson, yeah. And I read that the court cleared the way for him to file a suit now. Now, what in God's name could he possibly sue for? It boggles the mind.
It's absolutely insane. He says he was unlawfully seized or something like that. But as of right now, though, his lawyers can't produce him. We don't know where he is. So, you know.
Well, it's interesting that that ruling would just come down yesterday, or at least
it's been in there for 6 months. They've been sitting on it for 6 months, I think.
Really?
Yeah, the Eighth Circuit, yeah.
That's interesting. That's interesting that finally comes to light here. Well, this is clearly because the lawyers want to make money. This isn't about justice. This isn't probably even about that moron. This is about lawyers making money.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. There's no question about that. I mean, this guy has no grievance.
So you've been getting, the book has been getting a lot of attention. You've been on some major shows. I think yesterday you were on The View. How was that experience?
Yeah. It was a unique experience, I'll tell you. There's one of the young ladies that was there was, you know, very, very in tune with how the media can distort things. You know, she talked about that with me. But the others, the one, Sonny, told me that she was embedded in Ferguson before the riots, which... is kind of odd since the riots started within 24 hours of the shooting, really, or of the crime scene being cleaned up. So I didn't sit there and argue with her about it, but there would be no for somebody to be embedded in Ferguson before, you know, the shooting.
Yeah, before that aftermath. So she was playing it up like she
knew what was going on.
She was a player, right? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, people were coming up to her and telling her, you know, what was what and what the Ferguson police were doing to them, and And of course, in reality, you know, by the time she would have gotten there, there were people from all over the country coming there to, you know, rail against the police and to tear stuff up.
You know, did you ever discover who was actually behind much of those protests?
Well, there was a really good article, and I actually have a copy of it, in one of the Washington newspapers, I think Washington Post, that broke it down. And the money, you know, was a whole bunch of different, let's say, civil justice and racial justice groups and all these organizations that have whatever names. But the money upward, you know, it all comes up to a guy named George Soros.
That was it was his organizations that were funding all these paid protesters. That's a polite word. Anarchists that literally bust them into the city in order to create havoc.
Oh yeah, and you know, paying them by the hour. There were times when you know the unrest was dying, at midnight or whatever. It'd be cold. For whatever reason, you know, it would ebb, and there'd, you know, be 10, 12 people still out there, you know, chanting and yelling and whatnot. And we'd actually go out there and say, "Why don't you guys just go home?" You know, and they'd say, "Well, we're getting paid. You know, we're being paid to be here."
They actually told you that.
Well, some of them came to the police station initially looking for where they should clock in. We had a couple of people do that. It was hilarious.
That is, you know, that's the classic
story. They
didn't
know. They're just mutts from somewhere. Yeah.
where do we clock in to get paid for protesting against you?
Yeah, it was surreal. The whole thing was like being in the Twilight Zone, you know. But yeah, we'd send them to Greater St. Mark Church or wherever they were, you know, the couple of churches that were putting these people up.
Wow. Well, you know, I also remember that I was stunned by the inadequate response by your governor. Your governor was, I watched with my mouth open at his pathetic response to this.
Oh, it was more than dusting and cowardly. You know, he had political aspirations, clearly. You know, I think they were talking him up as being you know, the vice presidential candidate with Hillary Clinton, you know, so he was looking forward to losing the presidency with her. But but there was one point where he was talking to international journalists. I quote this in my book because I just want it for posterity, you know. He had declared a state of emergency, and so a reporter said, "So does that mean the bomb's with you?" And he started by saying, "Well, we want to let all voices be heard, and and just went on like that for, you know, 30, 40 seconds. And then so the reporter re-asked the question. And when you're the governor, you declare a state of emergency, and somebody says to you, "Does the buck stop with you?" in Missouri, where Harry Truman came from, there's only one word answer, and that is yes. You know, the buck stops with me. You know? And it was funny that the local newspaper said, "Harry Truman, he's not."
But, yeah,
but he just went on and on like that. He never took responsibility for his state of emergency declaration. And of course, you know, we were begging him on the night of the grand jury decision because, you know, we were overrun. We collected something like 3,000 empty shell casings the next that night of riots. And then, you know,
wait a minute. Say that again. You guys collected 3,000 empty shell casings from weapons that were fired during that night?
Yes. Yeah.
That's insane. I never heard that.
I know. Yeah, it wasn't news. What was news is we were deploying tear gas against peaceful protesters. And a few people burned some buildings, you know, of course. A few of the, you know, the people that were there as troublemakers, not the peaceful protesters, of course.
No, of course not. Of course not.
Yeah, no, the shooting was every night, almost every night for months. And you know, it's just a miracle that it wasn't until the day that I resigned that well, we had one Ferguson officer was shot during a burglary during the unrest, unrelated to it. But the day that I resigned, stepped down, two police officers were shot on my police station parking lot.
But that had to be just a bone-chilling feeling for you.
Oh, it was just horrible, horrible feeling. Yeah. Fortunately, they survived. You know, they had disfiguring injuries, but they're okay. They lived.
Wow. I was unaware of that. Did the city? How did they force? I mean, basically, how did they force you out? Did they just say, "Hey, look, you got to go"?
It was kind of when that DOJ report came out, and you know, no matter how much of a lie it was, there was no way we were going to be able to say that, because as soon as you say we don't accept this, and we're going to, you know, we're not going to work toward a consent decree based on this, then they file suit against
right.
you, and that's a million, you know, multi-million dollar endeavor. The chiefs that called me once they announced the pattern practice investigation, who said, you know, you are done for. This is already a conclusion here.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, don't think for a minute by you cooperating with them and being a nice guy that they're going to give you any quarter, any fair shake. They're not. It's over. And that's essentially the case. You it's a very difficult thing to find, especially for, you know, a small town like Ferguson. We couldn't afford to fight it. So this report came out, and essentially it's going to be accepted by, you know, the world as a true statement. and essentially I became, you know, the head of the snake, essentially.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
the city didn't force me out. We just kind of got together. You know, I sat down with the mayor and the city manager, and we agreed that, to kind of get the press off our backs and the government off our backs, that you know, we were going to have to get out of there and let them, you know, solve the problem, which, you know, of course means, you know, putting their people in place.
Well, when it comes down to it, you had an incredible law enforcement career. I mean,
I did, yeah.
I mean, 31 years, retiring as a captain with St. Louis County, and then 5 years as a chief, especially when you consider that the average shelf life of a police chief in the United States, I think, is about 2.5 years. So you actually landed, you lasted longer than most do.
Oh, well, that's something.
but your career was incredible, and the unfortunate events of Ferguson were a moment in history that will probably be examined and re-examined by historians and by law enforcement, you know, for years about, you know, what really took place. And your book, you know, is will be the textbook for that. And the book, you know, once again, is out now, right? It can be found on Amazon's in the bookstores.
Yes. Yep. It was released Monday. It was early released by Amazon, but it's in bookstores and Barnes & Noble, Amazon, several other websites. Policing Ferguson, Policing America: What Really Happened and What the Country Can Learn from It is the title of the book. And it, you know, I just, one of the reasons I needed to write it is for the very reason you just stated, is that this is going to be talked about in history, and there has to be something out there other than, you know, a corrupt Justice Department report.
Exactly. And I urge my listeners to pick that book up. You know, how is Darren Wilson doing now?
I actually talked to him yesterday. He was on chapter 8 of the book and really enjoying it.
Good.
Yeah. Well, you know, of course he's not doing what he wanted to do. But you know, blame the full weight of the United States government for that and the media.
Yeah, that's he is still the lone victim of the events of Ferguson. Well, you know, Tom, thanks so much for being on the show again. I really appreciate it. I wish you nothing but the best of luck, not just with the book, but what are you going to do with yourself now? Are you going to continue to write, or are you looking for something else to do?
Actually, and this is probably the first time I've said this in public, I'm giving some serious thought to running for the U.S. Senate seat held
Beautiful.
By Claire McCaskill.
Now you're talking. That is a great idea.
She was one of the people that truly victimized law enforcement. You know, she coined the phrase the militarized police and called our actions despicable. And that doesn't represent Missouri in any way, shape, or form, nor a police.
Well, that's excellent news. When will you? By what time do you have to declare officially?
There's no real time frame. The filing date is in February. So.
Well, that's great. I urge you to do that. I think this would be a fantastic next venture in your life.
Yeah, it could be an interesting journey.
It could be, indeed. Once again, Tom Jackson, the former chief of police, Ferguson, retired police captain, and now author of a book that is out on the shelves now and is kicking some butt, Policing Ferguson, Policing America, What Really Happened. And once again, Tom, thanks so much for being on Blue Lives Radio.
Really good to be here with you. Thank you.
End of watch.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we pay our respects to those men and women of the American law enforcement community who have given their lives in the line of duty. Unfortunately, I have three names to read this week. The first is Deputy Sheriff Jason Finn of the Yoakum County Sheriff's Office in Texas. Deputy Sheriff Jason Fan was killed in a vehicle crash at approximately 6 p.m. while responding to an accident on Highway 214, 2 miles south of Plains, Texas. His patrol car left the roadway and overturned, causing him to sustain fatal injuries. Deputy Fan served with both the Seagraves Police Department and the Yoakum County Sheriff's Office. Deputy Sheriff Joseph Jason Fan of the Yoakum County Sheriff's Office in Texas, end of watch, Saturday, August 5th, 2017. The second law enforcement officer to die in the line of duty this week is Police Officer Gary Michael of the Clinton Police Department in Missouri. Police Officer Gary Michael was shot and killed during a traffic stop in the area of East Green Street, North 2nd Street, at approximately 10:45 p.m. When Officer Michael stopped the vehicle for suspected registration violation, the driver exited the vehicle and opened fire. Despite being mortally wounded, Officer Michael was able to return fire. It's not known if the subject was shot. The man fled the scene in the vehicle, then crashed 2 blocks away. He fled on foot and remains at large. Officer Michael had served with the Clinton Police Department for less than 1 year. Police Officer Gary Michael, Clinton Police Department, Missouri, end of watch, Sunday, August 6, 2017. The third law enforcement officer to die in the line of duty this week, Detective Elise Ybarra of the Abilene Police Department in Texas. Detective Elise Ybarra was killed in a vehicle crash on I-20 outside of Abilene when her department vehicle was struck by another car at approximately 6:15 p.m. She and two other detectives were en route to Dallas to attend Crimes Against Children conference. They encountered slow traffic due to a previous wreck on the interstate. A few moments later, a pickup truck struck the rear of their unmarked car, causing Detective Ybarra to suffer fatal injuries. The two other detectives were transported to a local hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. She had served with the Abilene Police Department for 3 years, was assigned to the Special Victims Unit. She had previously served with the Sedalia, Missouri Police Department. She is survived by her husband and 10-month-old daughter. Detective Elise Ybarra, Abilene Police Department, Texas. End of watch, Sunday, August 6th, 2017. These officers join their brothers and sisters who, thus far this year, we have seen the deaths of 75 American law enforcement officers in the line of duty. This is in keeping with exactly what happened last year. Last year was a record-breaking year. Let's hope that that number goes down. May they rest in peace. Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I do appreciate you taking the time and the effort to listen, telling your friends all about it. Now, if you want to find me, go to Facebook and look under Randy Sutton, public figure. If you are a tweeter, I am at LT Randy Sutton. And, of course, my personal website is randylsutton.com. Feel free to contact me there or on Facebook. And don't forget, always check out bluelivesmatter.blue for all the information about the American law enforcement community.